I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Julia Barnes. Julia Barnes is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. She's the director of Sea of Life and Bright Green Lies. Her current work focuses on opposing deep sea mining. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk about Sea of Life first. What is that film? Why did you make it? And what has been the response?
So Sea of Life is a film all about some of the big threats facing the ocean, things like industrial fishing, ocean acidification, coral bleaching, and it's got a big focus, I think, on coral reefs and what's happening to them. But also kind of looking at the larger picture and just the crazy, you know, mass extinction situation that we're in right now, and kind of the systems that have led to this. I decided to make this film because, you know, I wanted to focus on the ocean and what's happening to it, because I think it's often kind of out of sight and out of mind for people. And also, you know, it's so big and so important to all life on the planet. Most of the oxygen in the air that we breathe comes from the ocean. It regulates the circulation of the planet. And I think most people don't really think about it or don't have any concept of what's happening to it. I wanted to make a film about that. The response has been really positive. It's been out for quite a while now. First did like a festival run and it won a lot of awards and it got seen by a lot of people. Some people have said that it's inspired them to get into ocean conservation. So that's been good.
You know, I think we perceive life on the planet, and you know, your movie helped me really to understand this, that when I think about life on the planet, the first thing I think of are, you know, trees or bumblebees or lions or something like that. But, you know, both by area, by volume, and probably by mass of living beings, I mean, this really is a water planet. It's that's where most of the life on the planet is, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Something like 80% of all life on the planet is in the ocean. So that's really where all the action is happening. That's, the foundation for life on the planet is the ocean.
So how did you come to, what made you choose oceans as opposed to grasslands or forests or mangrove swamps? What made you choose oceans?
I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense considering I had never been underwater in the ocean before I started making this film. But I guess I kind of grew up with a love for the ocean. I was fascinated by it, just like watching documentaries. And then when I was 16, I watched a film that went into a bit of detail about what's happening to the ocean, and that was what inspired me to make a documentary in the first place. Just learning about, the collapse of coral reefs and, industrial fisheries and the effect that they were having. And yeah, this was something that I thought was really important and needed more attention towards it.
So would you rather talk about what a healthy ocean is like, or would you rather talk about the threats facing oceans? Because I'm thinking about the what oceans were like. You know, I've read accounts of what oceans were like prior to much of their destruction, and frankly, it seems a lot of the accounts I've seen just seem unbelievable. So do you want to talk a little bit about that, or do you want to go straight to threats?
Yeah, let's talk about that. I think it's so important to understand what the oceans used to look like, what they should look like. Without that, we're not really in any way going to be able to address the problems, I don't think. This concept of shifting baseline and the idea that each generation adapts to an increasingly impoverished world that is devoid of life. Because, you know, we look around at what's around us and think of that as normal. But what that means is we lose track of what has been lost before we came into the world. And so much has happened in the past. Like, if you take someone on a dive on a coral reef today, they might come back thinking, wow, that was really beautiful and full of life. But someone who had been diving there 50 years ago might look at the same reef and say, this is hugely degraded. So we absolutely need to understand these historical accounts. They are absolutely incredible. I heard one and one that somebody talks about in the film is an account of sea turtles as some explorers were approaching Cuba. They said there were sea turtles in such vast numbers that they covered the sea. And the populations of sea turtles, of course, have been decreased by some like 95%. So we just can't even imagine what that world used to look like or have any kind of sense of it. I mean, the same is true of fish populations. Just about everything in the ocean has been decimated. And, you know, the way that I first woke up to this idea, I guess, was I did my first ocean dives in the Florida Keys and, you know, thinking it was really beautiful, and it was. But I went for lunch at a restaurant that was decorated with old photographs and images from the past. And I was just looking at like the size of fish that people were taking out of the ocean back then on recreational fishing trips. And they were enormous. And the types of fish, ones that would be really rare to find today. And I'm just thinking the ocean must have looked so different back then. And these were just pictures from like the 50s or the 70s. You know, and later I did more research into this, and there's a whole archive of them online from the Library of the Florida Keys, and you can just see so many mind-blowing images. There used to be a commercial fishery for sawfish, which is pretty heartbreaking because sawfish are very much endangered, and it would be so rare to see one in the wild today. But they were taking them out of the ocean in vast numbers back then, like hundreds every day. And you can also look at, there have been some things that people have done, image comparisons of a particular place on a coral reef, looking at it, you know, a photo that was taken maybe 20, 30 years ago, and another one that was taken in the same location, you know, closer to present day. And you can just very visually see the degradation. And that's not even going back very far, but it's just so obvious how much things have changed. And the fact that that's not something that most people are even aware of, I think it's really easy to lose track of a sense of what the world is supposed to look like.
I want to give a couple examples that I've read about. One of them is that there were so many whales, and I've heard accounts of this both from New Zealand and also San Francisco Bay, and also New England, that there were so many whales that people along the shore would say that it stinks because of their breath. And I can't imagine, you know, standing on a shore and there being so many whales that I can smell their breath.
Mm-hmm.
That's one example. Another example is that the cod fisheries were so, the cod schools were so thick that they would impede the passage of boats. There'd be so many cod in the water that the boat would actually not be able to go through. And that's not even talking about, I mean, then there's salmon where, you know, that the river would be black and roiling with fish. And it doesn't matter. I mean, the Hudson River was so full of fish that, they would, if you threw a net in, it would carry away your net. And they would one way they would fish for cod is they would just lower a basket into the ocean, and then you pull up the basket and there's fish in it. It's just, and I've seen so many accounts of that. It sounds like somebody's just making up some fantasy story, but we hear these stories all over.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember. This is sort of a dangerous thing because I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but I've read some accounts of some of the fish who spawn on sandy shores and them being so thick that like your horse carriage would go up to its axle in the water. Have you studied the sort of sand spawning fish at all?
No, I haven't. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, and I remember when I was a little kid, my mom talking about, before I was born, my parents lived in California for a little while, and I remember my mom would go out and go smelt fishing or during a grunion run, and you go out with a bucket, and you can just catch them. You put a bucket in a wave, and you would catch a bunch of fish.
Wow.
And I've never heard of that sort of thing. Maybe it still happens. I have no idea. Anyway, so do you have any other stories of how things were and how things are before we move into the specific threats?
No, we can move on.
Okay. So what are some of the primary threats that you deal with in Sea of Life?
So one of the main ones is the effects of industrial fishing on the ocean, and probably the most obvious and direct impact, just the mass removal of fish from the ocean. So there's a lot of different fishing methods that are being used that are, you know, quite destructive, efficient, and unselective. So things like trawling, bottom trawling, purse seining, long lines. There's enough long lines set in the ocean every day to wrap around the planet 500 times. Which sounds like a lot, but it turns out the amount of fish caught from long lines only accounts for like 2% of the total fish caught globally, which just, I think, shows you the scale of all the other fishing methods. It's just a massive amount of nets that are scooping things out of the ocean on a constant basis. And
wait, I want to go back to the long line fishing for a minute. Let's do the math. You said wrap around the world how many times?
500.
Okay, and isn't it like 26,000 miles around the ocean? Isn't that about right? Something like that?
Sure, I have no idea.
Yeah, I think it's 26,000. 26, let's say it's 26,000 times 5. 26,000 times 5 is 130,000 times 50 is 1.3 million. So that's 13 million miles. You said 500 times, right?
Yeah.
So that's 13 million miles of long line. And just, I mean, people have heard the phrase, but can you just talk? I know it's only 2%, but can you talk about what a long line, what that means, and then go through the others too?
Yeah, absolutely. So a long line is, like the name suggests, a very long line that is stretched in the ocean, but that's the main line. And then from it, dangling smaller, shorter lines that can go to various depths, some of them not too far, some of them deeper, with baited hooks attached to them. So it's a very unselective fishing method. Any creature who is interested in the bait and bites on the hook can be caught. So long lines have been known to catch sea turtles, even seabirds who dive for the bait and then end up drowning. Non-target species of fish, and a lot of times sharks are caught on long lines. So that's long lining. Trawling is just...
Wait, one more thing about the long lining. How long do they keep it? How long do they keep the lines out before they reel them in?
I don't know. It probably varies, but sometimes I would imagine a day or maybe 12 hours.
So this is even worse because... You know, I've been fishing before with hooks, and I fully recognize that when I catch a fish, I am torturing that fish for the amount of time that I pull it in before I kill it.
And it's horrifying to see footage of, like, fish trapped on long lines because a lot of times they are still alive, and they're just, like, swimming the largest circle that they can swim that the line will allow them to.
And they'll be tortured. I mean, I'm not excusing the fact that I've tortured fish with this, but it lasts for 30 seconds. It takes to reel them in.
Right.
And that's not 12 hours of having a hook in your lip, or in your gut or in your throat. and being, you know, slowly tormented until you're killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, of course, a lot of times fishing gear gets lost and just continues fishing indefinitely. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so the next type you want to go through?
Yeah, so trawling is just basically dragging a large net through the water column and catching whoever happens to be in the way. Bottom trawling is the same concept. It's that they're dragging a large net across the bottom of the ocean, and it's weighted down so that it scoops along the bottom. So that method, not only catching fish, but also removing the homes of fish like corals and sponges and whatever plants might have been on the bottom of the ocean, if it's in sort of a shallower water area. So even if a fish, managed to not get caught by the net, it doesn't have a home to go back to. So that was pretty awful. And then purse seining tends to be used for catching fish. Like, they'll use sonar to locate a particular school of fish, and then they'll bring these nets around them and close them in. So they can kind of target exactly where the fish are going to be and then just scoop them up.
And that's what are the, I mean, you have mentioned before, and I've mentioned before too, that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. Do you have any numbers on what the, like, how many tons of fish are removed from the ocean every year? How much actual biomass?
I don't have the number for that. I have the number for bycatch. It's 54 billion pounds of fish every year is caught and thrown back and wasted as bycatch. And usually the fish don't survive when they're caught and thrown back into the ocean. People might think they do, but they have air bladders in their bodies that explode when they're brought from the deep ocean under pressure to the surface with almost no pressure. I don't know how many total fish are taken out of the ocean.
Did you say 54 billion pounds of bycatch?
Yeah.
So it's 54 billion pounds of fish who are killed for absolutely no, I mean, not even any reason at all.
Yeah, just incidentally in the process of trying to catch other fish.
Yeah, and, you know, Chris Mazur wrote about this with forests, and other people have talked about it too, that, yes, it's horrible to cut down a forest. And then in addition, the simple removal of the biomass from the forest is something that forests can't sustain either. I know that the trees will grow back, but he's talked about how there's no forest in the world that can last through more than three cuttings, because it can't afford to have all those millions of pounds of simple biomass removed. And I have to imagine it's the same thing with the oceans, that, you know, I love the line by John Livingston, there is no surplus in nature. And every bit of food, every ounce of biomass taken out of the ocean is 1 ounce that is not available for food for somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's horrifying. And then it's never going back. I mean, it's all just being taken and nothing really returned. I suppose you could say we return nutrients to the ocean in the form of, like, fertilizer runoff and all of that, but that's not actually helping the ocean. It's just creating deoxygenated dead zones. So we're both removing nutrients and then pouring in vast amounts of unhelpful nutrients.
So I want to point out something too, that you said sonar, and I'm thinking about, you know, when hunters go hunting, the deer or the elk will hide, and they at least there's a possibility that they might not get seen. And that was, you could argue that was the case a long time ago with fishing, where, you know, the fish, they would have to still find it. But can you talk very briefly about what sonar has done to make it so fish can not even hide?
Yeah, fish don't stand a chance. We can pinpoint exactly where they are and go in and surround them and catch them. they really have no chance at this point of escaping this. If people want to take them out of the ocean, they can. I read something horrifying in a high school biology textbook, and it was the word unnatural selection. And I was not like an environmentalist at that point, but it really, I think, affected me profoundly. And the example that was given was of industrial fishing and the fact that because there's so much fishing going on in the ocean, a lot of fish species have, I don't know if you can call it evolved, but they've ended up becoming smaller and figuring out how to reproduce earlier, because the only fish that could survive in a given population are the ones that are small enough to squeeze through the holes in a net.
And, you know, you talk about that. Can you talk just a little bit about how big some fish can get, and also how long some fish can live? That's, I don't think most of us, myself really included, have a real sense for, you know, we're used to, I don't know, goldfish or something, but some of these fish, well, goldfish can live a long time too. But can't some of the fish in the oceans get, A, really big, and B, can't they live a long time?
Yeah. And a lot of the species that are more desirable for fishing are those, you know, and more profitable to catch are those species who can live a long time and consequently take longer to reach an age where they can start to reproduce. So they're the ones who tend to be, you know, diminished faster if there is fishing pressure. So yeah, like a lot of fish can be 50 or 100 years old. The longest lived fish species is the Greenland shark, who can live to be 400 years old. That's not really the norm, that's kind of the exception, but pretty cool. And yeah, like species like sharks or tuna, they're meant to live long lives.
So, okay, so what's another of the threats to the ocean?
Another one that I focused on in the film is ocean acidification. So most people, I think, understand the effects that carbon dioxide emissions are having on the atmosphere. But what a lot of people don't realize is that much of the carbon that gets released into the atmosphere doesn't stay there. A lot of it ends up getting absorbed into the ocean through the seawater mixing with air, with like wave action. And when carbon dioxide mixes with water, it forms carbonic acid and makes the ocean more acidic. In a more acidic environment, animals who build shells and skeletons can't form or have a harder time forming. And so the oceans are 30% more acidic than they were before the Industrial Revolution. Ocean acidification is something that has been involved in four of the five mass extinctions that the planet has been through in the past. And right now the oceans are acidifying faster than in any of those previous extinctions. So this is a big problem for coral reefs, who build skeletons out of calcium carbonate. It's predicted that by 2070, if ocean acidification continues, corals would literally start dissolving. But already they're feeling the effects of this, and same with smaller shelled organisms like, you know, oysters, clams, whatever. But even plankton, some of them build shells and are being affected by acidification. It's this huge threat to, you know, pretty much everyone in the ocean either builds a shell or a skeleton or depends on somebody who does. Coral reefs are really important, and I focused on them a lot in the film because they are home to 25 to 30% of all species in the ocean at some stage in their life cycle. So the fact that we're losing them is a huge problem. I mean, you don't just lose coral reefs, you lose a whole chunk of life in the ocean.
And talk about coral reefs a little bit more. You know, you said you focus on them in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, corals are amazing. So corals are actually animals. They have a cool symbiotic relationship with plants called zooxanthellae. They're these little algae that live in the coral's tissue. They give coral their color. They also photosynthesize and provide a lot of the nutrients that corals need to survive. So they have a symbiotic relationship, and corals will, as they grow, they'll strive towards sunlight to help the zooxanthellae photosynthesize better. Corals provide a home and some kind of protection because a lot of species don't like eating corals. Corals sting. So they work together and really rely on each other. And then as corals grow, they form structures, and there can be so many different types of corals. There's like branching corals, there's brain corals, named that because they look a lot like an animal brain. There are plate corals and fan corals, and there's also species of soft coral. And they all form the structure of the reef. And then this is really great habitat and homes for so many different species. Coral reefs are the most biodiverse natural communities on the planet. They can be home to thousands and thousands of different species. Kind of the well-known ones that you might think of when you think of a coral reef is like sharks and sea turtles and stingrays and moray eels kind of hiding in the crevices of the reef. And then there'll be fish of all sorts of colors and varieties and sizes. There's also like really cute little worms and shrimp, and you'll have lobsters hiding in the crevices underneath the coral. It's a really incredible place in the ocean.
So this may be an unfair question, but how does a coral reef start? So does it start on sand, or does it start on rock, or?
I don't know. I know that corals, well, actually, yeah, I would think maybe in sand, possibly. I don't know. Maybe it has to find a rock. The way that corals propagate, they spawn. So timed with the full moon on like one day a year, all of the corals will, you know, synchronized release a bunch of eggs into the water column and release a bunch of sperm. And it all like floats up and mixes together, and then it's just kind of drifting in the currents until some of them will end up, you know, sinking down and finding a suitable place to begin growing new coral polyps. I don't know if there's a particular substrate that they require.
Okay, so then you have a coral start, and then I have actually no idea how this works. So does it grow a teeny bit every year, like a tree with rings, and then get bigger and bigger, or?
Yeah, and kind of. Corals are like, they call them colonies of polyps. So, it, you know, it starts out with like one coral polyp, and then it kind of replicates itself and makes another little one. So each polyp is, think of like a teeny tiny thing that kind of resembles an anemone, or like the tentacles on a jellyfish. These are kind of their relatives, and it's this tiny thing that sticks out into the water, and they actually catch food that's drifting by in the currents. They'll eat like little teeny larval fish and things like that.
And then when you have a big, you know, we've seen pictures of corals, or you've swum in them. Mm-hmm. And is the whole thing alive, or is only the tip alive, or is the is like, and you said that the moray eels will live in a crevice. Are the crevices made of old coral from 500 years ago? I mean, how does all that work?
Yeah. The skeletons are kind of stacking on top of each other. So yes, the like rocky crevicey part is absolutely made up of old coral skeletons. But like a particular coral, if you see it, the whole coral will be alive. So there's like individual living coral colonies, all kind of attached, and a lot of them anchored around, like, say, a larger structure made up of skeletons of several thousands of years worth of previous corals.
Okay, thank you for that. So, and what are some of the threats to corals? There's the acidification, global warming in general.
Well, the other big one is bleaching, and the fact that as the oceans are becoming warmer, once corals, they have a very narrow temperature range that they can tolerate. So if the temperature is too warm for too long, they will do what is called bleaching, which means that they're releasing the symbiotic algae from within their tissue. They're releasing it back into the water column. So it's called bleaching because the algae is what gives the coral their color. And without the algae, the corals turn white because you can just see straight through them down to their calcium carbonate skeleton. And the corals can't survive for very long without these algae. So if the water temperature is too hot for too long, then that's the end for them. So more and more frequently, there have been mass bleaching events with coral reefs. There was like one that happened while I was filming Sea of Life. It was at the very end of it, and I got some footage of that and put it in the film. And all of the coral scientists who I spoke to in Australia were predicting that these mass bleaching events were going to, you know, really become a thing. They hadn't really happened before then, and become more frequent and more severe. And there have been, you know, several more of these since the film came out that have been so much worse than that first one. But yeah, you look at footage from that first mass bleaching event and it's like everything is just white. And it's been a real disaster for the Great Barrier Reef, having these successive bleaching events. The amount that corals can kind of maybe bounce back from and be okay is like if a mass bleaching event happens every 10 years, they can sometimes like recover from that. But if it's happening every year or every 2 years or every couple of years, like it is now, it's not going to be a good situation. So they're actually expecting that bleaching will wipe out corals before acidification does.
I know this is a smaller problem than the other two, but I've also heard that overfishing is a problem in coral reefs as well.
Yeah, definitely. Corals who are have been fished out tend to be doing much worse than corals who have abundant populations of fish around them. And that just makes a lot of sense. There's meant to be lots of fish on coral reefs, and they do a lot of things that help the coral. Like they'll eat off algae that might normally compete with the coral. They help it, and it's definitely necessary to have a good fish population around.
So what are other threats you discuss?
So that's it for what's discussed in the film. Another thing that I learned after making the film is that if even like a tiny bit of plastic is touching a coral reef, it will be much more susceptible to catching a disease, which I thought was really interesting. That's not in the documentary.
Yeah, and plastic is a real problem everywhere, but especially in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. Yeah, I can talk a bit about that. Yeah, plastic is a huge problem in the ocean. So many species will eat it thinking that it's food, and then their stomachs fill up with plastic and they starve because they can't eat anything that's actually food. Their stomachs are full. So like seabirds and marine mammals and also fish are really susceptible to this. But also there's so much microplastic just kind of floating around in the ocean. Yeah, and so fish are constantly ingesting this, because plastic, you know, when it goes out, it tends to just break down into smaller and smaller pieces. Doesn't really degrade, but it does become these tiny little chunks or flecks or whatever. And so, you know, filter feeders will ingest this. Even I've seen footage of like little tiny plankton who have pieces of plastic in their bellies. And so it just integrates into the food web, and like fish now have plastic in their tissue. So if someone eats a fish, they're also going to ingest microplastics. So it's just gone everywhere. And yeah, it's horrifying. And it's kind of funny because like the things that people tend to think about when they think about plastic in the ocean is straws or bottle caps or like individual single-use plastic. But I think the vast majority of plastic in the ocean, a lot of it comes from discarded fishing gear. So that's a big source.
You know, I remember reading about ghost nets 30 years ago, but I haven't heard much about them lately. Do you want to, I mean, because that's discarded fishing gear. Is that still a problem that people just don't talk about, or is it no longer a problem?
No, it's still a problem. I mean, yeah, there are big plastic nets out there. They're not going to be decomposing. And yeah, they're out there. They're kind of constantly, you know, moving through the water, or maybe they're like stuck down on a rock somewhere. And yep, sea life gets stuck and entangled in the nets, or if it's a drifting long line, you know, gets caught on the hook. No, it's terrible. It's a huge problem. I don't think it's in any way been solved. I mean, Sea Shepherd is out there like scooping a few of these nets out of the ocean where they can, but I think, you know, they've got a few boats and there's thousands of fishing boats operating every day.
You know, I don't. So there's something, there's a place I want to go in a minute, but before we go there, do you want to talk about sharks for a minute? Because sharks are an incredibly important species, and they're getting, many of them are getting hammered.
Yeah, absolutely. I love sharks. They're my favorite species to see in the ocean. They're just so beautiful and, you know, a lot of fun to interact with. Sharks are really important for the ocean. They've been on the planet for 450 million years. So they've been here since before there were dinosaurs. And most life in the ocean has evolved into a world with sharks. The oceans have really been shaped by the presence of sharks. And sharks, you know, control the populations of their prey species. They also make those populations stronger because they tend to eat the sick or weak or injured fish. Obviously, it's a lot easier to catch a fish who's not so healthy than to try and swim after one who's good and strong and healthy and good at swimming. And they make the community stronger in that way. But there's also like different ways that sharks impact the world around them that you don't necessarily think about. Like there's this seagrass bed community off Western Australia, and seagrasses are really important. They're generally eaten by sea turtles and manatees. And what they found is that the presence of tiger sharks in this community forces the turtles and the manatees to move around a lot more because they're scared of these sharks. So they don't end up overgrazing in any one area. So like you might not think, you know, having a shark in the ocean actually helps the seagrass bed be healthier as well. So yeah, sharks are super important. Their populations have declined by at least 90% on average. Sharks are targeted for their fins, for shark fin soup. They are targeted for their meat. For a while, they were used for their skin. Their skin was used for sandpaper. I don't think it is so much anymore. Their teeth and jaws are used as souvenirs. Shark liver oil is used in a lot of cosmetics and like skincare products. And yeah, so sharks have been really depleted from the ocean. I think it's something like 150 million sharks are taken out of the ocean every year. But also a lot of sharks are caught as bycatch. I think it's somewhere around the same amount of sharks are caught as bycatch as are, you know, caught intentionally to be used and made a profit from.
So I want to go back to this thing about the seagrass beds, because one thing I think is really fascinating is when the same dynamic plays out in completely different natural communities. Mm-hmm. So you were talking about them sort of chasing the manatees and sea turtles around. And exact same thing happens with wolves and deer or elk, where it really improves the habitat because they chase the herbivores around. And then just like about a year ago, I learned that the exact same dynamic plays out between spiders and grasshoppers, that spiders will make it so the grasshoppers don't get too comfortable, and they end up having a great, it's the exact same dynamic as it is on the other scales. I just find that tremendously fascinating.
That's really cool. Yeah.
So a place I want to go, we've got like 8 or 9 minutes left. And before we wind down, I want to talk about, Sea of Life. And something I thought about a lot several years ago, and I still think is true, is if you were to say to somebody 10,000 years ago that humans would, that you say, which of these do you least believe? That humans are able to end up sending somebody to the moon? That humans are able to communicate over long distance immediately? That humans are able to, think about some other sort of modern technological miracle? Or that humans were able to effectively destroy life in the ocean? I think a lot of them would have said, that the one with the ocean, that's too far. There's no way they can do that. I think that the amount that this culture has been able to destroy life in the ocean, it might be its most monumental accomplishment.
It is incredible. The scale of it and what it must take in order to keep the ocean, which is huge, continually in this state of depletion. Yeah, it is this like relentless taking from the ocean.
And I remember when I first, when I was a baby environmentalist, I remember reading about the ghost nets, and that was one of the most formative things for me in terms of, 50 years after the people made their money and 50 years after they've died, this thing is still out there killing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like mines, M-I-N-E-S, continue to toxify the environment 2,000 years. I mean, there are mines from ancient Rome that are still toxifying the environment. And it's just extraordinary to me how, I don't know what's extraordinary, just the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, something that's kind of horrifying to me is like the way that they're able to continue making profit even in an ever increasingly, depleted and degraded ocean. Like a good example I came across of this is, the famous collapse of the cod fishery in the North Atlantic. Like the population went from 4 million, estimated 4 million tons in the 1500s to something like 2000 tons in the 1990s. There was just this immense trawling and removal of so many cod. The fishery collapsed. But then what ended up happening is that fishing companies just moved on, and now they are targeting what used to be the prey species of cod. And so things like crab and shellfish and shrimp, whose populations have actually increased without the presence of cod, and now they're making more money than they were when they were fishing cod. So this horrible collapse that has been a disaster for the ocean has actually benefited the industry.
Yeah, that's pretty much this culture killing the planet, isn't it?
Yep.
So, a couple of things. One is, how can people watch your film? We got like 5 minutes left. How can people watch Sea of Life?
People can watch it at seaoflifemovie.com. There's links like that. You can order a DVD or watch it on demand on something called Vimeo on demand. Also, if people are in Canada, they can watch it on a streaming service called Crave.
And what are you working on now?
What am I working on now? Mostly on a campaign about trying to stop deep sea mining from happening, which is kind of this imminent new industry that is threatening life in the ocean.
You know, that's one of the reasons that I started to grow to understand that this culture has a death urge, is that, you know, it'll find one way to kill the oceans. And when that doesn't succeed in killing them, it adds another threat. So if it doesn't do it with overfishing, well, let's add ocean acidification. Well, that doesn't work. Let's go ahead and mine. And I know people argue, oh, that's just making money. But the effect in the real world is you add threat, and then you add another threat, and then you add another threat, and you add another threat. And eventually, whatever community you're targeting, it can't survive it.
Yeah, and, you know, the effects of all these things are kind of greater than the sum of their parts. It's like each of these individually would be horrible, but the ocean has to deal with all of this happening at once. And, like, you know, maybe a reef could withstand there being a few less fish on it, but then you add on top there's a piece of coral, a piece of plastic touching it, and now it's more susceptible to disease. Oh, and the ocean is warming, and the ocean is becoming more acidic. You know, and on and on and on. And it's just like, yeah, at some point there's a breaking point.
So, you know, I've been saying for years that, I mean, obviously nature, life wants to live, and nature can be pretty resilient. And if it's not pushed past a breaking point, it is extraordinary how much a forest can recover, or a grassland can recover. Or when the Soviet Union collapsed, there's 450 or something like that dead zones in the ocean, and one of them recovered. And what it was is the Soviet Union collapsed, made agriculture no longer feasible off the coast of the Black, or on the near the coast of the Black Sea. And so that dead zone actually recovered over the last 30 years. And so if industrial civilization were to disappear tomorrow, do you think that the oceans could recover okay? And if not, I mean, I'm sorry, if so, I mean, how much more can they be pushed before? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, there is a tremendous potential for things to recover in the ocean. If industrial civilization stopped tomorrow, I think it would mostly be okay. I mean, the plastic problem isn't going anywhere, but just about every other issue would vastly improve. There's a wonderful area off the coast of Mexico, or in Mexico, called Cabo Pulmo. It's just this kind of little area of the ocean. It used to be a fishing village, but they had so heavily depleted the area. Basically, there wasn't any future for fishing there. So they decided to create a marine protected area. They banned fishing. And within 10 years, the biomass increased by over 450%. I got to visit there when I was making the film. And it's just one of the most beautiful places that I've ever seen underwater, and it's so full of life. And you know, you're swimming around there and you're seeing these huge schools of fish, free swimming moray eels who show no fear, and it's just this incredible place that is so full of life. And it used to be practically nothing in the ocean there, like they had so heavily overfished it. So there is a potential for like incredible rebounding of life in the ocean, but exactly, like it can't be pushed too far. I mean, at some point, fish populations are not going to come back. The population of cod in the North Atlantic has not recovered since it collapsed many years ago. So there are limits. And I don't think that the ocean can be pushed very much further than it is right now. You know, with acidification, which is absolutely a threat to everyone in the ocean, is like the way that I learned about it originally was like, oh, okay, if we shut off emissions tomorrow, ocean acidification is going to stop. But as I talked to coral scientists when I was making the film, they were all telling me that there's a lag time, that it takes time for carbon that's in the atmosphere to equalize with the ocean. So if we shut off emissions completely today, ocean acidification could continue 20, 30 years, essentially enough time to wipe out coral reefs. So I think the only, you know, real way to prevent that from happening, and I could still see that it would be possible to do that, would be if we restored enough natural communities on land to actually sequester carbon out of the atmosphere before it ends up going in the ocean. But that would need to really start soon and be, you know, huge recovery of prairies and forests and, you know, bringing life back to the planet. That is the solution for a lot of what's going on, which would be great and not likely to happen unless we really do something about it.
Well, and I want to just mention, too, that you talk about prairies and forests. And I mean, the ocean has its role for that, too, with seagrass beds being really good carbon sequestration, mangrove swamps at the edge of oceans. I mean, so the ocean can sequester carbon, too, in a way that does not involve acidification.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for crying out loud, it can also sequester it through the bodies of whales, who then fall to the bottom of the ocean where the carbon's effectively sequestered.
Yes, definitely. We need more whales. We need to end all shipping so we stop running into them. And you know, that's a huge problem for whales, is just getting struck by shipping vessels. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, which, as I say this every time we talk, but you're one of my heroes. And so thank you for your work, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Julia Barnes, and this is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.